Chocula?
If my answers frighten you, Vincent, then you should cease asking scary questions.
All I do is win, 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 no matter what. Got money on my mind, I can never get enough. And every time I step up in the building, everybody hands go up. And they stay there.
Jocks. Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
From Chicago, PTI Worldwide Headquarters, it's Stocks and Jocks.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howard, Jimmy on the board. S&P futures down 11, NASDAQ futures down 55, so down a little, but not a real lot, considering we've been pretty much up lately, but we're down a little today. Do we have Professor Lou?
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
You too, bud. Did you have a good New Year and Christmas? Did you go skiing or do anything?
No, I was actually in East Tennessee visiting my mother, and came back with a cold and some other kind of stomach virus that, to quote the famous Haribo sugar-free gummy bear review on Amazon, you know, use these if you want to power wash your intestines. Had that kind of an experience. So
You didn't have to buy the cleanse stuff.
No, I did not. It took care of me very whatever that virus was, took care of me very effectively. And by the way, I will recommend the Haribo sugar-free gummy bear product review on Amazon for if you want to have a good laugh and keep laughing for a while. Read that commentary.
Oh God!
Those product reviews are absolutely hilarious.
Speaking of product reviews, did you see the one today about the? I won't say the fatso shots, the weight loss drugs.
Oh, Ozempic, whatever, GLP,
yeah.
GLP.
Well, now whoever did the they's, I always wonder who the hell they are, right? But studies are, I mean, it's been rumored. Proven whatever that an awful lot of people that have gone on big diets a lot of them gain all the weight back, right? I mean, it's whatever.
What I've read is that if you cold turkey that product after getting to your targeted weight, you will become ravenously hungry and start eating like a maniac. The trick is to come down off it slowly, supposedly.
Well, the study says you gain weight back four times faster than a regular diet.
That wouldn't surprise me. How do you
calculate that?
if you gain weight back four times faster than normal, I mean, they look at average weight gain, which tends to be long term.
Where do you get all the data?
Oh, I'm sure there's no loss of data or shortage of data on this stuff. Millions of people are using that stuff.
But I mean, if I drop 50 on this stuff and I put 40 back in a month, who do I tell this to?
Your physician.
Okay.
They're still monitoring people, right?
All right. Okay. All right, I get it. Right. So you can't get the stuff without a prescription.
Correct. And my understanding, again, I know some people who are using it. My understanding is that you're checked every 3 or 4 weeks for weight, you know, body fat percentage, loss of muscle mass, which is a huge issue if you're not exercising, and some other things. And then when you go off it, they require you to come back in and, you know, similarly to see how you're doing. And again, the guidance that I understand is being given is do not go off that stuff cold turkey. You gradually step down the use. The whole point of the program is to get your dietary habits to change. And so you you're making behavior changes, so you don't come off the stuff cold turkey. You step down gradually so that your body and your mind, that's the key, your body and your mind get used to eating less.
Wow, did you ever, you might be old enough, I'm not going to accuse you of being old. You remember something called the drinking man's diet?
I do recall that, yes.
That was that was quite a deal back when people used to drink a lot more. You can still find it online.
It was one variation of, it was the grapefruit diet, there are any number of faddish diets that came on and got people, supposedly got people to put weight or lose weight. And the irony is that the same thing happened. You step off the diet and you start gaining weight again. The most effective thing I've ever seen in terms of diets was the Atkins diet. And I put myself on that one time and it was very effective. And relatively, relatively safe. But
actually the drinking man's diet was like the Atkins diet with booze. Salads, lean meat, that sort of thing. No dressing, no rolls, no nothing.
Yeah, and the U.S. government just issued its new dietary pyramid, and it's inverted, where you used to have carbohydrates and breads and stuff like that at the bottom, where the base was wide, and you were supposed to eat lots of those. and then narrow at the top with high protein and dairy and eggs. It's now inverted, so that the narrow part of the pyramid is at the bottom, and that's breads, carbohydrates, things like refined carbohydrates, sugars, that kind of stuff. And then at the top, it's very broad, and that's protein, meat, eggs, some dairy, healthy fats, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre how it kind of goes back and forth. I mean, there is a huge difference between, you can actually get pretty healthy bread now if you want to pay up for it. But my brother bakes it every week for his two granddaughters, and a big difference between what he bakes and what you buy.
I make bread as well, and the two astounding things for me. Number one, I put it in the refrigerator after we're not using it, and it stays good for weeks. There are no preservatives in it. Now, I'm not pre-slicing it, and I will tell you that I understand where the expression, the greatest thing since sliced bread came from, because slicing bread is a pain, but it seems to last, at least as long as the preservative-loaded bread. And obviously...
Well, this isn't exactly Stacks and Jackson cooking, but how come there's a place here, I'll think
about it. Yeah, let's put a disclaimer up.
Yeah.
Do not follow us for cooking advice.
But how come some stuff, and I'll use this, two places I've gone, one is there's this, I assume it's still there, there's a spectacular, in a neighborhood maybe you don't want to go, I think it's in East Chicago, it's a little Mexican restaurant that is tied to a Mexican bakery. And there's also a place here, Jimmy, what's the name of the joint on Grand Avenue that makes the bread? La Scala or whatever the hell the name of it is?
Yeah, Scadala.
Yeah, and they still have a coal-fired... Now, I've been around a while. I go to an Italian restaurant and I can feel the bread and I can tell you where they made it, whose it is. Now, these guys, when you get it, it's got an amazing texture to it. But literally, Lou, at the end of dinner, you can use it almost as a weapon. It hardens up in this Mexican place. If you brought home, if you went there in the morning and brought bakery goods, you better have them for breakfast, because by the afternoon they're a weapon. I mean, I'm sure there's no, but whatever they use is, it's good for like 3 hours. I mean, I'm sure you could still eat it. I mean, it's not like stuff crawling on it, but it really hardens so damn fast. What is so different about that? Is it the coal fire thing that dries it out or something? I mean, what is the deal with that?
I that's a good question. I suspect one thing. So I make pizza from scratch, and that includes making my own crust. And the dough preparation for that is now a matter of, in many cases, a matter of science. And so I think my understanding is the dryness is that you're seeing there is a reflection of how much moisture they've got in the dough.
Maybe.
So if they're putting, and so pizza dough gets a different level of moisture than bread dough, which gets a little different level of moisture than biscuit dough, and it's really it gets very scientific in terms of, you know, measuring out, you know, certain number of grams of water versus whatever of flour. In a place, I think when I lived in Italy, when I was doing Stocks and Jocks from Bologna. Outside of Bologna is a place called Fico World, which is the grandfather or parent of the Italy franchises in the United States. So there's one in Chicago. I don't know if you've been to it. It's a really interesting mix of sort of restaurants and food stores. But Fico World is a Disneyland for food people.
Where is it in Chicago?
It's downtown somewhere. I can't tell you exactly where it is in Chicago. You can look it up. There's one in New York and one in Chicago. I think those are the only two in the United States right now. Anyway, in Bologna, this place is just outside Bologna. It's a 25-acre, 27-acre theme park for food. It's designed in a circle, and on the outside of the circle are food productions. So you literally have cattle, dairy cows, some truck farming for vegetables and grain. And then the next ring in is food production. And they show butchering, they show dairy cheese making, they show bread making, all that. And then the next layer in is food stores where you can buy the product. And then the next layer in is restaurants where you can dine. I've never eaten better in my life than I ate when I was in Bologna. I've never had the variety of food, the care, whatever. But one of the things when you go into Italy, if you go into one of the stores like the flour store, they have separate stores for flour, there are something like 125 or 130 different varieties of flour.
Oh yeah,
and mix. The Italians are experts in food. You know, I think more so than the French, but that's because I enjoy Italian cooking more than I enjoy French cooking. But when you go in there to talk to them about flour, first of all, it's an education because the store clerks are all fluent in English and they are more than happy to sit down with some ignorant American, and that would have been me, and explain the essential elements of flour and dough for breads, for pizza, for rolls, for breakfast breads, lunch breads.
And there's a way, there's a difference breads in the way it's processed too.
Well, yes, and you know, mainly they talk about how the gluten, you know, gluten levels and moisture levels and all this. So short answer is if you're at a place that is sort of fine-tuning its baking, I guarantee you they're using some kind of a grain or grain mixture that has probably a high gluten content, that then they don't put a lot of water in, or not a lot of moisture, and that I would think would cause the hardness after a few hours after it comes out of the oven.
Could be. Hey, I sent you some stuff yesterday in the midst of all the stuff that's going on in the world, which is kind of hard to keep track of. The undercurrent of it is investments. I mean, we're talking Venezuela, clearly it's oil. We can see how it all shakes out of whose oil it is and who gets to do what, and what these facilities are looking like now, and what the investment needs to be. But then yesterday I sent you the one about the what kind of missiles. Lockheed Martin is kind of toying around. Toying around is probably the wrong term, but we're getting a contract. Well, first of all, these are for Patriot missiles.
Yeah, the production of weapons. They're gonna jack the production of weapons like sky high for PAC-3 missiles and other
things.
Well,
let's kind of zero in on one of them because, you know, as you know, I have trouble with the big over the top numbers. I want to look at each individual contract and see what the hell's happening. And Evidently, Lockheed Martin makes a Patriot missile. What is a Patriot missile used for?
Patriot missile is a multi-million dollar missile that...
It's like five mil a piece.
Yeah. That is used to intercept aircraft and incoming ballistic missiles. It is an extremely expensive system. It's very effective in its latest permutation. It's been employed in Ukraine. And finally, I don't know what, you know, this is something that we talked about our defense industrial base probably a year into the Ukraine war.
Well, that's why this one came out. I sent you this thing yesterday, and it's kind of a specific one, so I thought maybe we could zero in on, okay, here's one, and here's an example.
Yeah, I can't open the article because it's behind the Wall Street Journal paywall, but I know the story. So the Patriot is being used in Ukraine, and they've been firing them like mad. Because of course the Russians have been shooting, you know, high end cruise missiles in. Interestingly enough, the Ukrainians were able to smuggle one of these systems up close to the front lines without the Russians finding out about it, and the system's got a pretty long engagement range. I mean, I think it's over 100 miles, and the Russians flew a bunch of their more advanced fighter bombers in close to the border to release glide bombs against Ukrainian targets, and the Ukrainians turned the system on and shot down, I think they shot down two right out of the gate, plus they shot down the early warning aircraft that was supposed to advise the Russian pilots that there was a missile coming inbound. So I think a very effective system, but it's so expensive that you can't just fire the missiles willy-nilly, and it can be saturated. The system, like any air defense system, it can be saturated. So the Ukrainians have been firing these things off right and left, and you know they're necessary for the defense of certain high-value targets like Kyiv, but the stockpiles are way down. And so finally somebody woke up. I don't say finally somebody woke up. People have been saying we need to jack up the production of these things for at least 3 years. And finally, you know, we got a new administration in that said, let's put some money on it.
Well, whether it's the them or who is, but they're now, but the numbers here, this is Lockheed Martin, by the way. Now, the questions here are we going to buy Lockheed Martin? Are we going to put some kind of a spread on in there? But these things are, I'm trying to figure out how big of the business of Lockheed this is, but they still have, now again, as we talk about this, I'm going to talk like some idiot who kind of knows what a production line is like, because I do. Lockheed still has a Patriot missile line going, so they haven't let the thing, you know, go void and have all the tooling out in the backyard. So they still have a line going, correct? And they've upped their number to, last year they did 620 of these things, which is a record, by the way, according to this article. And now the story is they're going to want 2,000 a year for the next 10 years. Now, okay, so probably means if they have, they did a record 620 last year, they're going to need at least two, maybe three of what they have now, correct? This is not just a question of working on Saturdays.
No.
To go up three times.
Overtime's not going to cover this,
yeah,
right?
So we're talking now whether they have the property that wherever these things are made, is there room for another, I'll use the term line. We're talking about a second factory, which is another whole bundle of stuff, right? Now the question is, can the Congress let out a contract for 10 years? And, you know, if all of a sudden the world is a very peaceful place 3 years from now without anybody having the ability to say, well, why don't you forget years 3 through 10 or something? On the legal side, is that even possible? And secondly, are we going to force Lockheed to do the investment without any upfront money, or is there going to be some upfront money? Are we going to make them do the financing of whatever it is they have to do, or is the money coming from? When I say this, I say this with some semblance of knowledge. When you can have a rail car contract, you can have a plane contract, or a building contract. You can say, Lou, build me this 40-story building, And by the way, when it passes inspection 5 years from now, I'll give you the check. Okay, that's one way of doing it, which means that whoever gets the job has to have incredible bank lines and has to have incredible everything else. You basically force everybody out of the business. But if you say, okay, I'm going to give you 10% of the building the day we sign the contract, and we have all these points along the way where I give you more money, where you never have to use your own dough, now all of a sudden you can, it's a whole different pricing thing, and it's all, now are they going to pay these guys on delivery of the missile? Are they going to give them some money for, you know, it's a big deal, if you're, big difference if you're, and these are kinds of stuff that nobody ever goes through, obviously, on radio or TV. But how you do this, first of all, can you commit to 2,000 a year at $5 million a pop and essentially make Congress pay that 9 years from now without any ability to cancel it? I think probably the answer to that is no. If not, if you can cancel it, does that mean Lockheed's going to want the government to pony up money up front for the expansion they obviously need to have? You can't go from 600 to 2,000 on some kind of expansion. I mean, there's how many variables you think are in this, Lou, and how many different weapons are we talking about? And this is pretty complicated stuff. And
oh yeah,
despite what you say, you know, you think about your feelings about our current administration, one of the things that even the most supportive supporter, I'll just say that, is that they change their mind every 30 seconds. And I've read last night was that there is an oil company that wants to touch this thing in Venezuela because it's so, nobody's writing a check for $1 billion to go in on one of these drilling places and try and fix it or whatever. Nobody wants any part of it unless all the details start. I mean, we're missing details, Lou. So is this going to happen? Is Lockheed a buy because of this? What percentage of their business is it? I mean, once you talk about something like this, I can just spot out like 40 questions before you'd even begin to throw a dollar at it, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, just to go back to your Venezuelan oil thing, I don't think anybody's going to do anything in Venezuela until they sort out how the government's structured. So you know, there are elements in Venezuela that are very pro-communist and pro-Marxist and pro-Maduro that are still, they're still there. I mean, the VP is that way. So it's just a question of how that transition works, I think, before anybody's going in there again.
Quick question, and this is, I don't want to start... When mostly people on the right continue to toss these communist socialist terms around, and I look at what I see happening and have seen in the history of Central America and South America since I've been reading about it, which is a long time, those words mean nothing. All it is is strongmen. They don't seem to care whether they're communists or socialists. They just grab everything. How is that communist? It's nothing. That's
the essence of communism.
Well, maybe not exactly.
It's a dictatorship. It's a dictatorship. It always is, and that's Marx too. So that's why I say Marx. I mean, Maduro was an unapologetic Marxist / communist.
Well, that piece of it, but Marx also had some economic thoughts that weren't all that. They weren't exactly dictatorial.
Yeah, Marx's whole philosophy was to the establishment of a dictatorship of the quote proletariat, which he believed would gradually evolve. You know, we've never had it happen. We've never seen it. Once the dictatorship of the proletariat gets in power, they kind of hold on to it.
We don't see too many dictators resigning.
No, so that I mean Marx's stuff is pretty half baked. I know you've read it. I've read it. But in any event, that I don't have a. I'm calling him a Marxist, and I flag that and a communist because the fact that when you get in with a government like that, there's a substantial risk of having your facilities seized and nationalized, and that's.
Well, you also have people that were there from foreign countries. Made it more sort of like a colony and stole all people's stuff.
I can't speak to that. I'm just speaking to what Maduro is, and you asked why I flagged him.
I flagged him
that way because that identifies the risk to the investment, and his successors have the same issue.
I'm just saying if they get thrown out, another dictator shows up. I don't know if the dictator read Marx, and heck, he's just a dictator.
I don't know, you know, that's one of the. That's one of the big surprises about the old Soviet Union. And I'll get to your question about these missiles here in a minute. But that's one of the big surprises about the old Soviet Union is when you go in and look at their documents. It's a really interesting book I read 10, 15 years ago that some guy had gotten into the archives. And he came out and said, you know, here's the real interesting aspect of what was happening in the USSR. They actually believed the stuff they were spouting. They actually believed they were working toward the perfect society. They actually believe their ideology, and that's counter to what a lot of us in the, you know, studying the Soviet Union in the 1970s thought. We thought they were just cynical, you know, they were just dictators.
Well,
they were actually ideologues.
Have you listened? Our friend Professor Hal has gone back and done a total deep dive on one course he was teaching regarding Karl Marx's work, and he honestly believes now that Marx is pretty much misunderstood because people don't recognize the era in which he was in.
Yeah, the late 1800s.
And he said the era that he's in is actually getting very close to what we're sort of heading toward here, a very serious crony capitalism sort of thing where, you know, a few people, what do you want to call it, a plutocracy or whatever, that he was against that. He wasn't all that necessarily, you know, the socialistic world like Sweden or anything like that. He just was seriously against the crony capitalism thing, which he thought was horrible, which, by the way, I think it is too. That doesn't make me a Marxist, but...
No, makes you an anti-fascist, right?
Well, pretty much. I would hope so. I would hope so. But I guess, you know, all we can do, Lou, is try and invest in some of this stuff, try and hope we end up on the right spot, but, I mean...
Let me go back. Okay, let's go back to these missiles.
I want one opinion out of you first. Why does it seem that in the other than really U.S. and Europe and Canada and a few other places, a lot of these countries in South America seem to at some point been on a real track towards whatever you want to call it, progress or anything, and then suddenly always seem to backtrack? I mean, Argentina did it in the 1920s really bad. These guys, John Flanagan's brother was in Caracas 25 years ago, and he said the place was gorgeous. The subways ran. They were on their way to being a real place. And all of a sudden, then they all just backtracked. These guys just get in there and just steal all the stuff, or what?
Yeah, they did get in there and steal all the stuff. Maduro's daughter, I think, is worth something like $4 billion. And Chavez's family has similar wealth. They steal it because they don't have a well-developed system of law, and because their military is heavily integrated into the governing of the country. You know, their military, they do not have the kind of tradition of civilian control of the military and the sort of divorcing of military forces from domestic law enforcement and domestic politics.
Let's leave that road for another day.
Yeah, I mean, but that's frankly why the vice president in Venezuela is still in charge and that other woman is not. So
yeah, why isn't the person who we think actually won the election, why aren't they in charge?
Because if we install her now, the country falls apart. This is the same problem we had in Iraq. So we're not going to repeat what we did in Iraq. We're going to look at who actually has the loyalty of the military, because that is the key.
Okay.
And say, you have to make a transition, or we're going to force things a little to be differently.
Because Christmas and New Year's were on a Thursday, we missed our Lou fix. We talked a couple weeks ago without you there, which made it less of an intelligent conversation.
I doubt that.
Well, no, we were talking about the fact that we don't have any shipyards anymore. Well, now we're talking at least with this Patriot missile, it looks like we have a line. We know we're going, and the people have the stuff. So expanding is easier than starting from scratch.
But so the contracts, I will tell you right now that whatever whatever is being done with on this. And I don't know what kind of contract it is. It's a sole source in some variation. Whatever the contract is, Lockheed Martin is not going to lose on it. So if they're stepping up to ramp up production to 2,000 missiles a year. Either somebody has got is writing a contract for them or has written the contract that says we're going to buy 20,000 of these missiles guaranteed,
which is the 2,000 a year for 10 years I was talking about.
Right, we're going to buy 20,000 of these missiles, or that's guaranteed, or you're going to build the capacity, we're going to buy the missiles, and if the contract drops off, we're going to guarantee a certain percentage of profit for your operation. There will be some kind of protection in there. I personally think that, and let me just note a couple of things. First of all, these missiles that are being produced are not going to be just, you know, standard plug and play kind of things. The ones coming off the production line initially will have the full set of upgrades that we have right now, but in 10 years that missile is going to get upgraded in any number of ways. Software mostly, but you know, capability, some modification in design. When I say some, it has to still has to fit in the basic Patriot launcher, but there'll be some modification in design. There'll be some change in
these whatever. Are launch. What do they launch from on Grand? What do you launch them from?
They are shipped in boxes, containers that contain the missile, and you literally lift the box and plug it into a Patriot launcher, the missile launcher. There's a radar system associated with it that travels with it, and
is this a vehicle?
Pardon me.
Is this a vehicle or is it?
Oh yeah, they're all. It's I won't say it's totally mobile, but it is mobile. And these
so it
trucks
could be on a ship or it could be on a
yep,
vehicle of some
yep,
kind.
In fact, there's been discussion about putting these things, you know, you I think the whole system fits in like three or four shipping containers. And you know, there's been some discussion about putting these on vessels. The system is in use in places like Israel and Germany and Poland and a bunch of other places. In Japan has I think at least one, although they've got pretty capable interceptors themselves. But in any event, the purchase of these things is going to be set up in such a way that Lockheed Martin is not taking a hit.
Who owns the Patriot missile?
The intellectual property for it belongs to Lockheed Martin. Once the systems are delivered to the U.S. Army, the Army owns them.
Okay, but what I'm saying is, if the drawings, the invention of it, after a certain number of years, does it become like, I use the term Kleenex, where...
No.
In other words, today, if we say, we really like this, we've been putting these things out for 25 years, you know what? It's the point now where we can send these drawings to Boeing and five other places and go out for bid on the actual production of it. Is that possible?
Not legally, no.
Okay,
if you want to do that, and we have done things like that before, you go to the manufacturer because these things don't roll into the public domain. The plans are all classified. So they don't roll.
I mean, they're not going to send it to you and me, but we might send it to you. But because one of my reasons why I'm going with this is I put together a system for, or actually a plan when I was at Pullman, when I actually had more imagination and was younger. They had a series of design and build contracts, really for planes and for railroad cars. There was a succession of them that really were bombs. And one of the solutions, I thought, especially with railroad cars, because we're not talking about weapons, is to have a design to separate the two and to pay Pullman, pay, you know, whatever, Boeing or Budd or whoever, to actually design and build and make the first two or three cars and finalize the design and then put the design out for bid. So the person who was there the first day didn't get to ream you 50 cars down the line. That there was a difference between those who could design it and those who can manufacture it.
Yeah.
So the question is something like that possible with something like this?
It is. So the way this would work, and as I said, the government's done this with certain weapon systems or certain defense products. You you sit down and you tell the manufacturer who owns the intellectual property that's classified, look, we need to ramp up production. We're going to distribute the production documents, plans, whatever, to other contractors. Now, you can negotiate with us about this. We'll pay you for this, so that you're not taking a loss on that. But you're going to lose control of your product because it's going to go out in the interest of national defense.
Well, how many different companies built B-17s during the war? Bunch, right?
I don't know about how many actually assembled the airframes, but a number of different companies started manufacturing components.
Yeah. Go ahead, I'm sorry to interrupt. So you're saying it has happened.
Yeah, it has. Oh, by the way, every government defense contract contains the clause that says this contract may be modified in any way at the requirements of the U.S. to meet the requirements of the U.S. government. There is a catch-all in there that allows us to come in and break it, to rejigger it, to redo it, and I mean, it's an incredibly dangerous clause, as you realize.
Oh yeah.
But the kind of defense community realizes, and so does the government contracting group, that if you game this thing and try to play it too often, you don't get any more defense contractors. So they, there's a very powerful incentive to keep this thing, productive and profitable for the root contractor. The short answer to your question is Lockheed is not going to lose money on this deal. The contract will be structured such that either it's a guaranteed order of a certain number of missiles. Oh, by the way, I suspect that if they do have to build additional facilities, if Lockheed's smart, they are saying, okay, our main facility is in wherever, Florida or someplace.
Is that one thing I was going to ask? Where are they? I have no idea.
I don't know where the Patriot. Hold on a sec. I'll just take a quick look where the Patriot is assembled. But
how many people do you think make parts for it? 50, 100, 200?
I think it's a bigger place than that. So the Arizona, Massachusetts, Missouri, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, and Arkansas.
Well, they can't have lines in every one of those places.
No, it's key production. I don't know where it's actually fully assembled, but we are also putting in joint ventures in Germany and Japan, Tom.
Okay.
So Raytheon is the prime contractor. Lockheed is assembling it. So this looks...
How does that work? Raytheon does all the software and parts?
The parts flow to the assembly facility, and they get put together there. But it's this reflects this
how
distributed manufacturing reflects our political reality,
how many things
jobs.
Can you plunk on a galaxy and take them somewhere? Probably 30 or 40 or 20.
Well, they don't. I don't know how they transport. The missiles are typically transported by ship, hold on a second, I'm just looking right now. All right, so the Lockheed is building the missiles in Camden, Arkansas. That's the production line.
Okay.
So they're either going to expand Camden, or they just built a new facility there. They're going to expand it. I'm just looking at the article. The motors are made by Rocketdyne. Aerojet Rocketdyne out in, I think, California. So you've got a lot of distributed manufacturing here. So it's not just like an automobile manufacturing line where the steel comes in one place and comes out a car the next. This is electronic components. This is guidance systems. This is aerodynamic services. This is the rocket motor body.
Well, if there was an auto guy listening, he's going to be mad at you. He's going to say, what do you mean? We got tires, we got this, we got a zillion parts on our car.
Yeah. So the assembly facilities are in Camden, but everything flows apparently into there. So the question is, are they going to build more facilities in Camden, or are they going to build them somewhere else?
I got to believe Camden's on some serious railroad line in an interstate.
Yeah, okay. So that makes perfect sense. So, yeah, chicken or egg, was that there first, or did Lockheed spur the development? So the contracts will will specify, here's how many we want, here's the time frame, here's either the total order number, here's the profitability. Well, by the way, we're going to be adjusting the contract as we go along. And this is really interesting to me because we had a long talk a couple of, maybe 2 years ago, about our defense industrial base changing after watching what's happening in Ukraine, starting to change to a more rapid production of slightly simpler but very competent kinds of weapon systems. And Anduril Industries and some of the others that we talked about, where they can 3D print, for example, the bodies of drones or their specialized aircraft or their specialized boats, and turn them out fast. And the idea was because what we were seeing in Ukraine and what we think we'll see in any war in the immediate future is the mass use of drones and autonomous vehicles basically overwhelming systems like the Patriot. So the Patriot is there, I think, and we're ramping it up to deal with ballistic missiles. The surface-to-air, you know, aircraft and stuff like that's going to be dealt with by something else. But the Patriot, which, as I said, you know, $5 million a shot, you know, what you're trying to do is protect targets that are worth more than $5 million. And so typically that you're talking about a ballistic missile strike.
Yeah. You're not going to be shooting down like a drone with a $5 million thing, I hope.
No, and that was the problem with our Navy in the Gulf against the Yemenis. The Yemenis were launching $50,000 to $75,000 drones at ships, and we were shooting them down with SM-6, SM-3 missiles that cost $1 million a pop to hit these things. And so there's been a whole rush to come up with more effective means that are cost effective.
I'm always wondering if you could take a World War II, not that particular motor, prop aircraft with about 5 cannon on the top of it and do a better job against drones than we're doing now.
Well, the short answer is yeah. And so you've got a couple of different systems that got fielded. One was these unguided they're called Hydra rockets, that were used for air-to-ground strikes that have now been modified so they can be laser-guided. And so if you're in an aircraft or a helicopter or even a drone with these rockets, you know, and the rockets are relatively cheap. They're less than $10,000 a shot, I think. You can put a laser on the Shahed drone or whatever it is that's moving at you know, 200 miles an hour, and you put a laser on that thing, and then you fire the rocket, and you get a kill for less than the cost of the drone.
I almost think some flak might be in order.
That's another option. And you know, the issue with flak systems, of course, is that the aircraft has to actually fly over you. If they don't fly over you, you can't hit them. But in areas where you've got high value targets, those things make a lot of sense. They're cheaper, and you've got systems that can.
What if you see like 30 of them coming at you? Why don't you just time it to blow up right when they get to a certain spot?
Well, if you know where they are and they fly within range of the gun, you can do that. But you know, the attacks.
For those that don't know, flak is like a hand grenade in the air, right?
Yeah, it's a gun that shoots shells that explode either in proximity to the aircraft, which is the way they usually work.
Watch 12 o'clock high, and you know what flak is.
That's right. So those systems are there. Another effective system is a laser. And the Israelis have put Iron Beam in place now. It's operational. And that's a 100-kilowatt laser that can engage targets literally like bip, 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 bip.
In your
bip,
opinion,
bip, bip.
The people that have, that are capable of expanding their minds a little bit, people like you, same thing with the ships. Okay, forget what we have. What do we need going forward? There always are people like that, and it's not, you know, it's not always the younger people. There's some really inventive older people. Are they shipped off into a room in the Pentagon? Do they talk to each other? Do they come up with plans? Do people actually listen to them? Or is any of this knowledge, because I think we actually have a lot of knowledge, did any of it percolate its way up until there's a desperation thing, or are we just kind of stuck in a rut until something bad happens? I mean, it's a very grossly large question, but...
So there are lots of people at universities that are thinking about this stuff. One of my favorite initiatives was DOD 10 years ago, 15 years ago, went out and brought in, I think, 10 or 11 science fiction writers who specialized in military science fiction and sat them down and said, walk us through what you think war is going to be like and give us your insights.
It's a brilliant idea.
I know that West Point, and I hate to give the Army credit for anything, but as I've frequently said on this program, the Army, the Marine Corps, and the Navy are, in my opinion, much more intellectually agile than the Air Force. At West Point, they sponsored a military science fiction writing program, a contest, that got some fantastic stuff out about what war could look like in the future, and how certain weapon systems would be deployed. Really, really interesting stuff. So, short answer to your question is, they are looking at that. The leadership looks to develop intellectual capital. There are places like DARPA and other offices within the Pentagon that.
What does DARPA mean?
Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Okay.
You know, they're the Star Wars guys. They are sitting down constantly looking at new weapon systems, upgrades, things we can do, new technologies that are coming online. So they're heavily involved in lasers and particle beams and new sensor systems. The joint standoff weapon that I've described on the show before, which was basically a bomb containing 30 some odd submunitions that when the bomb was released, the submunitions would separate from the bomb and then they would fly out looking for, you know, the program to look for a tank or an armored personnel carrier or a truck, or if they couldn't find any of those, just to explode in a fragmentation pattern to kill people. That weapon was a DARPA project. And you know, I mean, so many... It almost looked insanely complex when you looked at what happened, because these little bomblets, the bomb would be released. You'd throw it at like an armored column or a parking revetment full of trucks and armored personnel carriers. The bomb would come apart. These little bomblets would come out. They were parachute stabilized, so they'd fall vertically with these parachutes. And then as they got to a certain altitude, these little rocket motors on these bomblets would fire up in a way that they would spin this bomblet.
Were you wearing your tin hat when you were designing this?
Listen to this. They would spin these little bomblets up to a certain revolutions per minute underneath the parachute, and then that would throw out these little things that are about like three times the size of a hockey puck, but they looked like hockey pucks. And they would fly out, and as they were flung out over the target area, they would spin, and they had a little sensor in the bottom that would look as they were spinning, and the sensor would see, I see a truck, I see a tank, I see an armored personnel carrier, and they had little vanes on these pucks that could steer them so they could fly
really
towards the target.
So it sounds like a saucer.
Listen, it gets even better. They would, as they flew toward their target, they would, at a certain height above the target, there's like a pound of soft copper in each of these little pucks. The explosion would be a shaped charge that would convert that copper into a molten metal jet that would burn down at like 3,000 feet per second and about 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and it would burn down into the top of the vehicle, burn through the light armor on the top, and then explode into the interior of the truck.
This is better than anything Scotty ever had.
So one of my classmates at the Air Force Academy was involved in the deployment of this thing. They actually used it in Iraq a couple of times. But he deployed this thing, and I said, This sounds impossible. And he said, we referred to it as the weapon of 13 miracles. because 13 miracles had to occur before this thing would work. And it, I said, and did it work? He goes, oh yeah, it worked. He said, we only dropped one of them on a group of Iraqi vehicles that were massing to make an attack on a bunch of Marines outside of Fallujah or Marjda or someplace like that in Iraq. And so one aircraft dropped one of these, and it killed 25 vehicles.
Wow.
Instantly. So,
well, anyway, but how do you, so I mean, it,
so the short answer is yes. I think it was called the Joint Standoff Weapon, the JSOW, which,
because well, I'm you know, as you know, I'm always, I don't know why I'm hard on about this, but I would much rather in today's world have 20 smaller aircraft carriers that may have vertical landing or drones or something that we could fire out. I don't care if they're diesel powered or whatever, instead of the 10 we got out there that are sitting ducks. I just think we need the flexibility right now. I don't know anything about what you were talking about, but flexibility right now and more of stuff to me seems more important than these incredible, huge things.
Tom, the Chinese just unveiled last week a shipping container that could ride on any of their container ships that contained vertical launch tubes for long-range anti-ship missiles.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. I'd rather have a bunch of smaller stuff that harder to hit and maybe whatever. I mean, I would like... Plus, how do you... Oh yeah, boy, I go back to Mayor Daley asking me, how do you get Pullman started again? And the look on my face must have been something that he never saw before. How do you get a shipyard started again that closed down 20 years ago? Do any of the, whatever we call it, things, the dry docks work? I mean, is all that destroyed? Is it just still sitting there? I mean, is it even possible? Do the cranes work? Are they all rusted? Do they tear it all down? Or is it all... Our apartment buildings there? I mean, how do you even go? Does anybody have a clue what we're even talking about?
They've restarted steel mills. They'll restart shipyards. But it's gonna take a while.
Well,
it's not gonna be instantaneous.
We had a steel expert on the air, and we could have him back on, Bob, or my softball buddy, and does steel coatings. He knows an awful lot about the industry, and he goes, all this crap about not having the capability here. He says, if you went out with bid for the bow of four aircraft carriers, it'd be five guys that would answer the bid tomorrow. He goes, we have capability on all this stuff. You know, we don't have it at U.S. Steel, but we have capability.
We have capability in that regard, but in terms of shipbuilding, I mean, I suspect a lot of what we're going to try to do in the short term, because China's just outbuilding us by such a wide
margin. Have 300 shipyards. We have six.
Yeah, I think we're probably going to end up talking to Korea, South Korea, and Finland, Sweden. You know, Viking cruises has. I think their boats are built in Finland, but they turn out. You know, they turn out a couple of ocean. They were for a while turning out a couple of ocean liners a year.
Well, I mean, and John Lee on Monday went, and there's only seven schools now that even do marine architecture here. Seems like not very many.
Nope. And you know, and a shortage of training places for people to staff these. I mean, one of the best service academies in the world is the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy, and in terms of just producing guys that can step right out of school into a boat. And that place does not get the recognition that it needs.
Where's that?
It should have.
I know Coast Guard's on Long Island. Where's the Merchant Marine Academy?
Merchant Marine Academy is at Kings Point, New York. Okay. Coast Guard Academy's in Connecticut.
Well, I thought it was on Long Island. Connecticut, okay.
No.
It's in
Connecticut.
I have a question, and well, that much time, but the issue with our people getting killed in Syria a few weeks ago, and then we bombed a bunch of places. Why do I always have these basic questions, Lou? What exactly are we doing in Syria? And if we have a compound there, what do you do all day? Do you go out on patrol? Do you just wait for somebody to shoot you? I mean, what do you do? I mean, what is the purpose?
My understanding of what we're doing in Syria right now is sort of the civic action stuff that our special operations guys have done traditionally, which is training we embed. That's how those guys got killed, by the way. They were killed by a Syrian military person.
Are we working for the new ruler or no?
To the extent that we're supporting or trying to get their military up to Western standards and try to integrate their military operation with ours, yeah, we are sort of working for the new ruler because we're
so it is their... it is a sanctioned. We're working with the guy. He wants us there, whoever the guy is. I mean, you know the name of the guy, and it, so it's. I use the term above board. We're not just out in the parts of Syria that are no man's land with a bunch of people hanging there wondering what's going to happen.
Officially, that's right. Do we have special operations teams that could be inserted or that might be, you know, in the field? Yeah, that could be happening, but it's not official.
All right, I mean, it's you kind of wonder when you hear somebody getting killed. What's, you know, my first question is, what are we doing there? Do you just sit around all day hoping somebody doesn't shoot you, or are you doing something? I mean, these are questions that... I mean, they're real questions, aren't they?
No, they're training. They're training the civic action guys are training the Syrian military. The surreptitious people, you know, they're out there collecting information for the most part. You know, it's literally the secretary will disavow any knowledge of your action kind of thing.
All right. Well, so is that guy gaining control? Is the place better than it was a year ago or not? I bet we don't. All this stuff drops off the front page, doesn't it?
Well, yes, it does. What I've seen is it sounds still pretty chaotic. You've got an issue with the Kurds in the north who are trying to organize into some kind of nationality. You've got the Turks who are trying to increase their influence in that region. The Israelis who have, you know, effectively staked claims to a significant portion of southwest Syria, I believe, to protect their proxies who are the Druze. And you've got this guy in Damascus who's military is fractured along tribal lines and religious lines, and he's trying to pull it together. I think it's very much like
I don't know if I'd like the guy, but I wouldn't want that job, would you?
No, and I think it's very much like what you see in Eastern Africa with tribal, you know, local tribal influences predominating over national influences, and all centering around this stew of Islamic, Christian, Jewish conflict.
Oh God, I don't know what the resolution of that is. I'm not smart enough. Is anybody?
The resolution is what they had, which is a dictator, a strong man who comes in, like Tito or Assad, who comes in and brutally suppresses the intertribal conflicts in pursuit of a national consensus.
How did the Romans manage to get all dictators, up until Caesar, they all did leave?
They had a quasi-democratic structure that was very powerful and everybody bought into because it worked.
Every once in a while, if they had a problem, for those that don't know Roman history, they would if they had two consuls and they had the Senate and they had all that stuff, and every once in a while if they had a big problem, they'd go grab a guy like Lou off his farm and say, okay, we need one guy making decisions for a while. Take care of this crisis, will you? And you would do it, and he'd say, okay, crisis over. I'm going back to my farm, and you'd walk out and leave. Dictators don't leave anymore, do they?
Well, not in that region because they get killed. I mean, it literally is a do or die kind of job if you take it on. And like I said, I think a huge part of that problem. Of their problem is the influence of Islam, which is a theocratic religion. You know, Islam is a government system, not just a religious belief.
Hey, if you got one more minute, we're over a second, but this Maduro, you know, we just went and got. I've forgotten where did Chavez come from? Was he homegrown or did he come from?
Yeah,
somewhere
he was homegrown.
He was homegrown. Okay,
he was a homegrown populist, and he was freely elected, and then just ran roughshod over everything.
Jeez.
You know, he got the military, got them making money, got them enriched, spread the authority over 2,000 generals I think they have in their armed forces.
Well, when did all the oil business start to go into the crap hole? Was it under him or under this guy?
Chavez ruined their oil industry.
Well, why would you do something like that? I mean, that's so insane. It's crazy. It's one thing you got going for it.
It's incredibly profitable.
I know, but why would you, I guess my point, why would you ruin it? That's your cash cow.
Well, he was still making money.
Oh, all right. Well, all right, buddy. Well, good to see you in the new year. And good stuff. You're still with the firm. Next week, we got to. Why was Harbaugh fired? Are you his agent?
Oh, I can talk. I was going to talk about that this morning. I have lots of insight into what happens with coaches. I think it related to his assistant coach. We can talk about that next week.
Well, you know, it's so bizarre. You look at these guys and you realize how hard it is to do what they do, and you see how these injuries, especially this year, have really affected these teams. I mean, the fact that Hamilton didn't play the second half was all the difference in that game with the Pittsburgh, wasn't it?
And the fact that they weren't running Henry when I thought they should have.
Well, and then, but I was up at the local Emporium talking to my attorneys the other night, and I said, you know, why did he get fired? One guy goes, he's supposed to be a sports expert. He says, what do you mean? Didn't you watch the game? I go, what are you talking about? Didn't I watch the game? Because the guy slipped on a field goal, you get a fired a coach? I'm like, what are you talking about?
So short answer, my understanding from some friends is that he was told to fire his offensive coordinator, and he has a lot of loyalty toward his assistants. And in that regard, he's an old-style coach. And I mean, because that was my father's thing, too. You be loyal to your staff. And he was loyal to his staff. And they told him to fire the offensive coordinator. And he said, no, I'm not going to do it. It wasn't his fault. And they said, okay, goodbye.
There must have been something behind that, them blaming him and him blaming them or something. It must have been some bad
feeling. I think there was plenty of animosity there already. But anyway, I feel like I've just eaten totally into Andrew and Wayne's time. Guys, you're wonderful. We'll talk to you all later.
All right. You guys both on? Our geniuses?
Yes, I'm here.
Good morning. Hey, how are you?
Happy New Year.
Happy bleeping New Year, as they say. Yeah. as we pile into this this new year.
Is 2026 over yet? This last week seems like it was a whole year.
Well, it sure does, doesn't it? What did you think of some of the stuff that Lou and I don't know how long you've been at, but the idea that in every one of these now places is mostly because of Ukraine, we're up in the defense thing and how these contracts are put in. The one I think I sent you guys, the one about Lockheed Martin and the Martin and the Patriot missile, is how many of these different things are there out there? We got shipbuilding. I mean, are we talking hundreds and hundreds of things we're buying, or thousands, or how? What are you sensing? Is there
Trump announced that he has personal control over all of Venezuela's oil, so I guess we got lots of money now to go buy stuff.
Oh God! Well, I get the part about, actually I don't get it, because that's why I'm dying to have you guys on. I haven't talked to you in 3 weeks, and this is such a tangled web, and yet the people who support this person or don't support him try and make this all out to be simple, but it really isn't simple. I mean, you have just look at the Venezuela thing, just from a broad brush. It's not just running in and grabbing a guy and his wife and knocking off 80 people. It's, okay, the Chinese are in there, and they've been giving people these loans in return for natural resources. So the idea is they're going to give these guys, they give them $60 billion, and they're going to get paid in all this oil. But the dudes are so incompetent that the Chinese are getting what? A third or a half the oil they're supposed to be getting. So they're getting stiffed in the first place, right? And all of a sudden, we're kind of pissed off now that they're in our hemisphere doing anything. Well, I don't know if it means they can't come here and make a deal with somebody. I mean, on the one hand, we're shipping them chips that we're not supposed to be shipping them. On the other hand, we're not supposed to make a deal to help out Venezuela keep their oil things. So this whole set of rules here, I don't seem to have. Are they written down anywhere, or we make them up as we go along?
Oh, wow. The Donroe—it's the Donroe Doctrine now.
Oh yeah.
Well, Chief, let me weigh in a bit. First of all, Wayne and I were talking that by coincidence of the calendar, Thanksgiving falling on a Thursday, and then Christmas and New Year's.
Yeah.
We're glad to be back because we missed you. But three Thursdays out. Going to your question, there may be a simple answer that a lot of us don't want to think about, but the dramatic events in Venezuela, Minnesota, and elsewhere are making some people think maybe there's simpler explanations. And here's the essence of it that Paul Krugman wrote about this morning. In Venezuela, the costs of the military are borne by the taxpayer, U.S. taxpayer. And it's a fortune. It's a huge amount to keep a fleet down there. But if the benefits go to a few people, insiders, it becomes more explainable. So a huge Trump supporter named Paul Singer invested in Citgo, and he stands to make billions of dollars out of this.
Well, okay, Citgo, in order to gas stations here, they were somehow, this is 15, 20 years ago, sort of bought when Chavez was there. They bought part of the company. Where does that stand now? Because I've lost track.
Well, there's a great column again this morning by Judd Legum, an investigative commentator, and he pulls it together. He actually broke the story about a week ago. The essence is that Singer bought bonds of or other investment vehicles in Citgo, whose specialty is refining the specific type of oil that is common in Venezuela. And this company, Citgo, is greatly undervalued as long as the taxpayers of the U.S. have had years of sanctions against Venezuela and their oil, with the exception of Chevron.
Why are they still there? That's another. When you're done with this one, how do they still have a toehold?
Well, it's influence peddling, and bottom line, and we don't want to think about it but events almost make us think about it, because it is a explanation that kind of makes sense, as these two columnists this morning point out in different articles, that it helps explain Greenland, Canada. It's much harder to extort democracies to pay tribute than it is to work with, let's say, the Venezuelan dictatorship or other dictatorships, because you can put the squeeze on dictators, whereas, you know, trying to put the squeeze on Denmark or Canada is a lot harder to just funnel money right into the pockets of our rulers.
Well, the funny you should mention what you just did, because I talked the other day, I don't know if you listened in or probably didn't, but there's a YouTube video where a guy was talking about what's this Venezuela thing all about. And I don't know if it's all about, but evidently, we have a lot of refineries here, because we used to get a lot of oil from Venezuela and from Saudi, by the way, which is, I think, kind of the same sort of crummy oil. It's heavy. It's got some sand in it. And refineries, I'm not an oil engineer, but refineries are not set up. You can't show up with tar sands from Canada and shove them into the Whiting refinery and expect the thing to refine it.
Correct.
I mean, refineries are set up for, I don't know, they must have some flexibility, but not very much. And when you look at the numbers of oil right now, we're essentially drilling about the same amount as we're using, but there's not a match. The fracking oil is I don't know if it's sweet, but it's light, right? And so we don't have a whole lot of refineries that are kind of set up for that. And this guy identified 10 different places in the Gulf that are either, you know, percolating along at either not at all or, you know, at half capacity or a quarter capacity or something, that are dying to get Venezuelan oil to the extent where we could actually probably export at a profit some of the other stuff to other people, because we don't have the ability to refine that as like we do this. And it's all this oil mixture sort of thing, which is kind of the same thing you're saying, Andrew, that there's, you know, we could really use this type of oil, even though if you look at the numbers, it doesn't look like we need any oil. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. But and very, very special people with very special political donation strategies are able to identify these assets that are undervalued for a reason, basically sanctions and so forth, and then say, well, suppose the sanctions are removed.
Yeah.
Those companies have a huge increase in value. And we don't want to think about it because, you know, for one thing, the slogan is make America great, not make insiders great. But
they think it's the same thing.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
They say a man, God helps the man who helps himself or something along those lines. Is it?
Yeah, that's the song.
The intelligence, as Lou and I were talking about, I'm trying to zero in as best I can to cover all these bases with sort of everybody. And these are multi-year projects. I mean, who exactly? Citgo was a U.S. company that was bought.
It originally was City Service, and,
right?
You know, yeah. And I remember they had a monopoly. They ran all the gas stations on the New Jersey Turnpike.
But they were bought into by who? Is it the Brazilian oil company PVS?
Yeah, well, it was originally, I believe, it was the Venezuelan state oil company is PDVSA. My Spanish is rusty, but it's the Petroleum Company of Venezuela.
It's the Pemex of Venezuela.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No different. And by the way, Venezuela nationalized its oil industry under Chavez's quote-unquote democratic predecessor, who was also very much an autocrat, but he was our autocrat, a guy named Carlos Andres Perez. And he did that in 1978. And you don't hear about him because he was our guy. And we just kind of grinned and bared it, you know, bore it. But now I understand that Citgo, when it came out that, you know, we were having troubles years ago with Venezuela and Chavez. Remember, he called George W. Bush the Diablo, the devil. He's at the UN General Assembly.
Oh, yeah.
And
he said,
it still smells like sulfur up here because,
God.
Because Bush spoke there the day before. And I understand that they rebranded. And it's the Valero, which we have a lot of those stations here in the South, including Florida. But that is for many parts of the country. It is odd. It's the South. Maybe they did that just for the South. It's Valero, which I don't know where that came from, that name. But
well, you know, this is all about because my stepfather's been dead. I'm going to say 17 years and. And down in, he was in the veterans home in Manteno. So I'd always drive down and see him every Saturday. And there was a big Citgo station across from the Shell. And I remember that for a while, the Citgo station, nobody was buying Citgo gas because it was un-American. Remember, because they were owned by Chavez.
Yeah, they don't mind buying it from Shell, which is Royal Dutch Shell.
Yeah, I mean, this was a hot topic. I'm going to say right about that.
Or BP, for that matter. And, you know, people in Louisiana were boycotting BP because of what they did in the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, this was like 2008. This was all a hot topic. Yeah. You don't want to buy Citgo and because of Chavez. Now, I mean,
he was a bad guy. And I'm just a little concerned. I wrote a book about Bush and his oil companies and all the other skullduggery that family has been responsible for. And it's called Jaded Tass. I wrote that, I think came out in 2006. But I was at the UN, and Chavez knew about the book. And I used to appear on a network that's based in Venezuela called Telesur. And they would translate my English and the Spanish, but Chavez knew who I was, so I'm at this sort of news conference. Chavez ends it, walks by, and I said, "Señor Presidente." He looks over. He yells out my name, and he gives me a bear hug.
God.
All these corporate media guys are giving me the fisheye, like, who the hell is this guy, you know? And but I used the occasion to give him a copy of my book, which I had signed to him. And on the same trip, I met a guy who was friendly with the then foreign minister, Nicolas Maduro. And he said, "Hey, listen, do you have an extra copy of that book? I want to give it to Maduro." I signed it to Maduro. So I'm just hoping that when they snatched him down there, they didn't take note of
find your
books in his library, because I'll have ICE here at my place any day now.
Well, there's the history of this. We went over with Jan Flanagan the other day a little bit. I mean, oil was discovered in Iran by a Brit, right? And it started the whole Middle East thing.
Yeah.
And everybody's history in the Middle East seems to trace down the oil stuff. And we've been over there since the next day, okay, basically farting around. And but people have gone into these places. They've taken, they built the stuff. I mean, there's no question that the foreign companies put in the investment. I don't know whether the deal was a good deal or a bad deal. You know, for the people who live there, it might actually have been a good deal. I don't know. But somewhere along the line, they all seem to get some strong man that comes in, says, "Okay, we got to get these guys the hell out of here." They kick them out. But by the way, leave your stuff. You know, we'll run it, which they never seem to be able to do. And everything goes flying back down again. Then people trying to take their stuff back. I mean, it's almost like a rotation here that just keeps rotating, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, but don't let's not forget the importance of sanctions in hurting these economies. So, for example, part of the news situation these days is whether Cuba will fall. And I, as an analyst, not politically driven, but just as an analyst, we've got to say part of the reason that either for Cuba or some of these other countries that their economy is bad is years of sanctions and trade policy.
Andrew, do we specifically have sanctions on buying Venezuelan oil, or we have sanctions on them sending it somewhere else?
I think both. I think we're doing it with Iran. We threaten countries with secondary sanctions. So we sanction the country, and then we turn around and sanction any other country that's doing business with that.
But what? But are the nature? I'm trying to find the where this all started with Venezuela. Are we sanction them because they were trading with Russian people we don't like, or do we just sanction them out of the blue because we don't like them?
You said it right there. But now we come up with all kinds of, you know, well, they're, you know, supporting Hamas and Hezbollah. You know, all this stuff gets rolled into it. And but they just stopped that reflagged Russian tanker,
right,
in the Atlantic.
But I mean, for how long has it been that we can't buy, nobody here can buy Venezuelan oil?
Oh, I think this goes back to the Obama administration.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
And if it, one of the clarifying moments of this kind of awful horror show, in my view, is that we see now that it's not about recreating democracy or some vestige of it in Venezuela, because if that was it, we would have welcomed the opposition leader who won the Nobel Prize and her colleague, who most people think won the recent election. Instead, we're sticking with the dictators.
And by the way, I just want to add there, yesterday Trump signed an executive order pulling the United States out of every UN and UN affiliate and non-UN organization dealing with the promotion of democracy overseas. So sorry, Andrew. I had to get that in there.
Anybody who thinks that Trump finds democracy anything other than an irritant better start looking, opening their eyes.
No, and again, the clarifying moment of this is you say, well, why would they, all of these years of sanctions to improve democracy, why are we sticking with the dictators? And again, this article I quoted today that seems to make sense is because it's much easier to work corrupt deals with dictators than people who have to go through democratic procedures.
Well, Luke claims it's because the army is so intertwined, you got to keep the army involved.
Well, that's accurate, but and one of the reasons I love listening to Lou is he has a command of the facts like that, but often facts lend themselves to a couple different interpretations.
Well, the interpretation is we're not trying to change the place of democracy. We're trying to just get our peace. That seems to be.
Yeah, they learned something from Iraq, and remember the de-bathification scheme over there. We got rid of anybody that was part of the Saddam Hussein spoil system, and then we found out that that destroyed the entire infrastructure of Iraq. You know, by doing that, you know, the water systems failed. You know, everything failed. The economics system was fractured and destroyed. And so, remember, Colin Powell said, he talked about the Pottery Barn rule. You break it, you own it.
Yeah.
And I guess, although I think we've done enough to Venezuela already, where we've already kind of broken it. But we'll see what happens when it comes time for us to own it.
And also, let me toss out, and I'm not totally sure of the dollars and cents on this, but it's my impression from following this at the time more closely that the money extracted out of that war in Iraq for, let's call them the insiders, was less about getting oil and selling oil than kind of government contracts to sustain our presence there for all those years, which led to some, you know, really ridiculous and in a way situations, as well as horrible situations.
Do you guys,
such as trying to win support by bringing pickup trucks with dollar bills and handing them out to villagers to try to get support.
Do you guys, we got a few minutes before break. I'm totally ignorant of this, but I'd really like to, not that I'd want to be shoved in there for 3 or 4 weeks to find out, but since the Chavez has taken this thing sort of downhill and you've got, I don't know, God knows what the unemployment rate is in Venezuela, and how does stuff even, how do you get on the bus? The currency is like no good. Does anybody have a job? Does the bus driver get paid, or does he just take some? I mean, what is daily life like? I've never been in a place like that.
It's funny you mentioned bus driver. You know, Nicolas Maduro's started out as a bus driver in Caracas.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
Okay. Yeah. He came up through the labor union movement, and I would imagine the situation there with their currency is probably fairly worthless. But it's probably ironic that the U.S. dollar is probably being used in a lot of transactions there right now.
Well, they allege they only have a 5% unemployment rate, yet 80% of the people are in poverty. What do you do? Yeah. What do you do? Go somewhere and not get paid? Are you working? But you don't. I mean,
it could be a barter system too. I mean, they are fairly self-sufficient in food because it's such a diverse agricultural country. Everything from, you know, mountainous areas to the tropics.
Well, some stuff has to be working, or I can't imagine what would life be like here if all of a sudden none of that stuff worked. None of your bus drivers got paid. None of your police got paid. And you could go to the store, you don't have any dough, but somehow or another you're working, doing something. The chaos that would ensue, I can't even imagine that.
Horrible, and that's why we had all these refugees, and some of them literally walked from Venezuela, try to escape through the jungles and come up walking or otherwise through Central America and Mexico.
Is there even a road? There's not even a road through there, is there?
Well, not in the Darien. It's called the Darien Gap. Yeah, it's between Colombia and Panama, mostly in Panama. And yeah, the Inter-American Highway goes from Alaska all the way to Tierra del Fuego at the end of South America, except for that area right there. There's no roads there.
It was horrible. But it's augmented by our sanctions because we had geopolitical reasons to oppose the government, and the government was horrible. Suddenly we've made peace with them. So here we are.
Well, let's, what do you say we go to break? Because I want to try and tie together this whole thing with these chips to China and this. The group down there that they just arrested for going to smuggle the damn things, and all of a sudden we're going to send the chips to China, but now we're pissed off China gave a loan to Venezuela. The inconsistency here just seems crazy to me. S&P futures down 5, NASDAQ futures down 32. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some may be embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
This is a true sad story for ADT, the leader in home security systems. My favorite dog, Oliver, was stolen from our garage recently. If I had a camera system installed in my home from ADT, I would have known exactly what car possibly pulled up in my driveway and stole my little friend. If I had a security system from ADT, my dog would still be here. I called ADT this weekend, and they're coming out in a few days to install a camera and a new security system. Unfortunately, it's a little too late for me. Listen, protect everyone you love in your family. Call ADT now. Have them come out and give you a quote to install a full security system in your home. Don't let it be too late for you. Call right now.
Paid for by the Home Security Hotline. 800-200-6543. 800-200-6543. 800-200-6543. That's 800-200-6543.
Listen, are you a 50-year-old person looking for term life insurance? Then you need to talk to Bob. Bob specializes in helping people find $1 million or more of term life insurance for a couple of $100 a month. Look, you need to know there's a price war in the term life insurance business, and you may be paying too much. Call Bob, and he'll shop and see how much money he can save you. Look, this could be the last term life insurance policy you ever have. Your rates are guaranteed for the next 20 years. That's right, guaranteed level rates for the next 20 years. And if you're a smoker or your health is not perfect, Bob has great rates for you too. So for $1 million of term life insurance coverage for a couple of $100 a month, call Bob right now. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. That's 800-989-1415. Paid for by Term Direct.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now.
We're
back.
Low and Open Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Jimmy on the board. Real quick, S&P futures down 8, NASDAQ futures down 44. We've got a quick over in Europe. We've got the Europe DAX down 72. Defense stocks are all up. Go figure. FTSE down 32.3%. We're like down 0.3% across the border, so down but not very much. Just a little bit. Over in Asia, Nikkei down 844, 1.6%. They were way up the last couple days. Asia-Pacific markets mostly fall as Trump rattles defense firms and oil prices slide, as he said. But no buybacks, no other stuff. Now he wants to take it for all those places, too. Hang Seng down 309, 1.1%. Shanghai down 2, call that flat. Bonds up 3 basis points, 4.17. That's as high as we've seen a 10-year in a while. Oil up 88 cents, but still 56.87. Remarkably, no response since this whole thing is almost the exact same price since before any of this stuff happened. Gold down 22 bucks, 44.39. Actually got a $2.90 move down in silver today, 74.71. First move down there in a while. We have foreign exchange. Dollar's flat, 116.7. Actually was stronger the last couple days against the euro and against the pound. The pound's 134.3. It was over 135. Crypto down 1,100 bucks, 89,839, so back under 90,000. Jimmy, what do you got for a quick traffic, weather, sports? Bulls suck and college game tonight, right?
There is the college game. Miami plays. Currently on traffic, we are at 23 minutes from the Kennedy to Montrose on the and the Jane Brown interchange. The inbound Edens to from Edens to Lake Cook is 36 minutes. Also on the inbound Eisenhower from Wolf is 37 minutes, and the Dan Ryan right now is at 37 minutes. So we are increasing. Weather in Phoenix, a high of 59, is currently 54 with brief showers. In Chicago, right now it's almost 46 degrees and the high is 55. We should have periods of rain and possibly a thunderstorm. As Chief has pointed out, the Bulls lost last night 93-108 to the Detroit Pistons. Back to you.
Guys, the thing that is I think the thing that bothers me the most about this whole mess, but I want to talk to you something about something really bizarre in a couple of minutes, but the you read about this NVIDIA thing, and I really get the feeling this NVIDIA guy is playing this Trump like a fiddle. But we're not going to put we're not going to ship China the best NVIDIA chips because they can use it for military. That's the story, Morning Glory. Well, all of a sudden now there's articles saying, well, they're not shipping them the stuff, they're renting them cloud time to use the stuff here, which to me is even worse. I mean, how stupid that could be. So of course, as you might expect, because you guys have been around a while, there's a group of goofballs in Texas that have organized this big smuggling operation to actually buy the chips here for allegedly regular purposes, package them up and sell them to China at somewhat of a profit. Well, duh, you know that's going to happen somehow. That's just the way the world works. Then all of a sudden, we have somebody, evidently, I don't know if it's the Justice Department or Texas or somebody, they get onto these guys. And the day they're either going to arrest them or did arrest them, the Trump administration says China can buy this stuff anyway. Okay, so now this we think is going to help go right into their Defense Department stuff. Now, meanwhile, they put some deal together with Venezuela, who's hurting on their own regard, plus our sanctions didn't help. Not saying we were wrong with that. They lend them a bunch of money for stuff they need to do or for their own pockets or whatever for the guys inside in return for getting oil from Venezuela. Of course, maybe because of our sanctions, maybe because of their own incompetence, they don't pump out enough oil for China to even get the oil, so they're essentially getting stiffed on their loan. And now we go in and we take this guy and we kill a bunch of people. And everybody I talked to said, well, I said, why are we doing this? And they go, yeah, I don't understand, Chief. They're only 300 miles away. They could put missiles down there. I mean, the missiles they put down there, are they going to contain the same crap they just were able to buy up here from NVIDIA? I cannot make... I feel like if I shake my head, my brain's going to fall out of an ear here. I really do. I mean, I cannot put heads or tails on any of this stuff.
Well, it's hard because, you know, there are people in this country, and many of them, that live in this information echo chamber It's not just Fox. It's, you know, it's others too, and the social media influencers. I mean, we're supporting people around the world who have international criminal court warrants out for them, including Putin and Netanyahu. But Trump loves those guys. And Maduro never had a Interpol arrest warrant issued against him. I mean,
yeah, I don't. You know, it's a. This is kind of. I was talking to a mature attorney. Even I think even older than you, Andrew. Sorry. Yeah, and what I've sort of noticed, even with maybe a few people on the show, and certainly other people that I know otherwise, is, and I had a couple of experiences in. You know, in corporate world, one at Pullman and one at the CBOE, where Pullman hired a guy, I was not on the board or anything, we hired a guy to be vice president of finance, and I just was on the same floor as the guy, and in like 2 days, I realized this guy was a tool. I mean, he was useless. But somebody had recommended a headhunter firm, they got the guy, they recommended him, and a few guys on the board went to bat for him, and we get this guy. And he's nothing. He had absolutely nothing. He was useless from day one. And but it took a long time to get him out of there because the people who backed him were men of enormous egos, which probably we all are. Never could turn around and say, "Look, I made a mistake." The same thing happened in the SIBO, and I was on the board for maybe a month. They hired this guy, and he was an empty shirt. And it took a couple of years to get rid of him because people who backed him would always say, "Oh no, he's got it all figured out. Just give him a chance." And I'm kind of sensing the same thing with some of the Trump supporters, in that it's reached the point where it's not about Trump; it's about them. They couldn't have, and I don't know why people are like that. I mean, I guess I know it's human nature, but I voted for Obama the first time. Thinking that maybe, even though I knew his record, you know, and only sort of got shoved in there.
And I think we can say all three of us did that.
Yeah, and but then after 4 years, I realized. I mean, I don't think he was a bad guy or he wasn't a crook or anything. I mean, I don't know, but he seemed to be didn't apply himself. He had the biggest thing going in the world with the healthcare. Seemed to detach himself. Was not a guy in enough detail. We ended up with a horrible bill, and I just was like, you know, he's kind of a stuffed shirt a little bit. And I didn't vote for him the second time, but I never thought that I sort of, because I voted for him the first time, I had to defend him, and no matter what he did, I had to. But people seem like they feel like they have to do this for this guy. And tomorrow, I mean, if he pooped in the middle of Constitution Avenue, it's like, no, he's okay. He's got a grand plan behind him. And people write really good articles regarding the Chinese influence here, and they attribute it to his thought process, and I don't know, it may make sense, and it does make sense for what you read, but I don't think it has anything to do with what he's doing. I mean, people just spend their whole day trying to justify stuff that to me is getting less and less justifiable. I mean, where am I?
Yeah.
And
I think he's a mafia don, and everything is like, you know, look at The Godfather. Yeah. You got Trump.
Well, I talked to my attorney buddy last night. I said, you know, you're my friend. I've known you forever. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about? And he goes, you should see the city. If somebody appoints a judge, and it turns out after 2 years the guy has no idea how to be a judge, try and get him out of there because the person who put him in there will defend him no matter what.
Well, here's what I was going to say, two points. One, we're talking about human nature, so 150 years ago or so, Mark Twain said, it's much harder to convince somebody with logic that you're right than to convince them that they were once wrong. I mean, people are just going to defend their past views. And more specifically, we're in this age where a lot of our media, whether it's Facebook or TikTok or larger entities that we know about, including CBS and some of the other big networks, they're in effect, bought off. And let me be kind of specific. I mean, part of the Russian propaganda efforts here in the U.S. have, it's documented, are targeting social media and getting people that you think of as just some concerned citizen to spew out stuff that's targeted to exactly the person who would be receptive to it. So when the puzzlement of the what are people thinking can be partly explained that big segments of our population have been targeted. Maybe that's too controversial to comment on, but actually Wayne has studied that quite in depth, as have I.
Well, so what is, I mean, I know if you listen to, fortunately I go to a place and it's on, is it, listen to like Newsmax and whatever, it's you listen to it, and then, but I go on YouTube and I'll watch somebody's, listen to somebody's Democratic things. They're idiots too. I mean, there's nothing of substance there other than a bunch of drivel about the other side.
Well, that's good ratings. I happen to know the founder of Newsmax. In fact, he's a friend of mine, I guess I'd say a professional friend, Chris Ruddy. So he got his start really at the New York Post as a reporter, and then his big breakthroughs were working on scandals or kind of scandal-like material early in the Clinton administration, such as the death of Vince Foster, the White House counsel. He wrote a book about it. And
Was that thing ever solved, Andrew?
Well,
funny, not really. was one of my first investigative stories.
Yeah, I mean, some of us think we know what happened, and we could share that with you now. But even Chris Ruddy, when I was looking into it years later, 10 years ago, he said, "Oh, don't bother with that." And I thought, here's a guy who wrote the book about it. He's gone on to be head of Newsmax, and partly because he liked some of the stuff that I did. He had invited me to send stuff I write that I thought might be helpful for Newsmax. But he said, "Oh, don't look into it." Now, we could explore, Chief, why that might be and what we think really happened. But it's technically unexplained. Well, let me amplify just for a second. Remember who was looking into it? Ken Starr and Brett Kavanaugh, his assistant,
yep.
Now the Supreme Court justice. And I would run into witnesses who say, "How come they never called me?"
And also, I'd add that Ken Starr, the late Ken Starr, was also one of Jeffrey Epstein's attorneys who got him the sweetheart deal.
Yeah, actually, I interviewed Ken Starr about that. It was a brief interview, but I got what I needed. I said, "How come?" Can I? Maybe I'll tell that story. I said, he was head of Baylor University, and he was speaking at the National Press Club about the importance of teaching Christian values or religious values to young people. And he had somebody from Yeshiva and another person from a Catholic university. And so the three presidents were talking about, you gotta give moral instruction to the kids, not just education. And who was that left?
Me.
Yeah.
Well, wait till you hear the punchline.
I'm still crying over it.
So here's the story. I was up, frankly, in the bar waiting for the Q&A period, and I was with two very devout Catholic gentlemen who were friends of Wayne and me. They were like mentors to Wayne and me, and I said, I'm going to go down and ask Ken Starr why he represented Epstein, and one of them said, "Oh, I want to hear this." And I came down during a Q&A part, and things were breaking up where I thought I could talk privately with Ken Starr. And I said, "Well, I'm a reporter. You're here at the press club. I do have a question. Why did you represent Jeffrey Epstein?" And he said, I can't get into that. That's an attorney-client matter. And I said, "Well, I'm an attorney. I'm not asking for any secrets. I'm just saying, asking personally, why did you, out of all the clients you could have had in your private practice, why represent him on his criminal charges?" And he said, "Well, all right. Well, he was a very good client of the firm." And I said, "Thank you, Judge Starr," and I left. And my friend, the late Michael Hurley, a physician, he said to me as we were leaving, "So it was all about the money."
Well, yeah. But, you know, it was astounding what you two gentlemen had. These names keep coming up all over the place. There's 330 million people in this country. 329.9 don't have any idea what's going on. It seems like there's 1,000 people whose names just keep swirling around other countries and here and other. Is that true, or is it just my impression?
Well, we've put ourselves in a position, as mentioned, to, you know, kind of encounter these people. But let me mention one other story about Ken Starr, since this is Stocks and Jocks, and we got to get the jock element here. I'll ask your listeners if you know why Ken Starr had to leave being head of Baylor. Think about it for a second.
Was there a football scandal, wasn't it?
Yeah. I'm going to tell you what the scandal is. And when I put it in a few blunt words, you will get the picture. Whereas a lot of the major media, it's a one-day story, and they're kind of writing about it in oblique terms, so you don't quite get the picture. But it was a football recruiting scandal. And so Baylor, to compete down there in Texas, was doing something that even in the football mad Texas and the Southeastern Football Conference and Basketball Conference didn't do anymore, which was to have welcoming committees of the prettiest girls to welcome the high school star recruits and show them what a good place it would be to go to college.
Shades of Rick Pitino, huh?
And so, you know, this is innocent in conception, I suppose, or presentation. But if you get a bunch of high school star athletes and pretty girls together, well, what could go wrong?
They're going to go out. They're going to go out and have a pitcher of Coke.
Well, so what had happened was there was something like 80 complaints of assaults or attempted assaults against the girls at Baylor, and people said, "What the heck was Ken Starr doing, putting up with this?" When most of the, even places like Wayne's beloved Ole Miss wouldn't.
Oh, God.
Well, isn't the same thing that,
what the problems are going to be.
Is this the same thing that Rick Pitino got bounced out of Kentucky for?
I'm not sure it was that. That might have been a money situation.
I think there was entertaining of somebody going on, and he claimed he had nothing to do with it. Was all the assistant coach.
Oh, yeah.
Coach.
Well, they all claim that. But the particular irony of Ken Starr is that was such a righteous guy, you know, because he made his whole thing on the made his bones.
Yeah, what would Paula Jones? What would Paula Jones have to say about all this?
Good.
Yeah, all of these scandals against Clinton, and then he's involved in Jeffrey Epstein and the football hostess scandal.
And isn't it funny, Bill Clinton has also been, well, I don't think he did anything wrong as, you know, others have, but you're right, Chief.
It's the same people all the time, isn't it?
You know, I can't get over the part of, I think I sent it to you guys, the YouTube video regarding all the different phone messages people were making on their phones between the two islands. And evidently in this country, as scary as it may seem, you can track just about anybody's phone calls if you want to. In Europe, you can't. So they traced right. all these guys back to all these different... How dumb or arrogant can you be if you land at the Big Island? Can't you keep your phone off going on the little shuttle over to the other island where there's a 14-year-old girl waiting for you? I mean, do you really have to proclaim to the world that you're there? Hey, we got a couple minutes.
It's the hubris of being powerful, I think.
It must. Hey, mm-hmm. We got a few minutes left, and since we are Stacks and Jacks, all the stuff you're hearing about investments. Now, today, you know, yesterday people wanted to get into Lockheed. Now, today they're talking no buyouts, no dividends, no, you know, whatever. So Trump wants to run the country companies, too. but, I mean, I guess my question is, since, you know, I'm looking at the beginning of the year to where to put people's money all the time. Last year, fortunately, we were in a lot of the metals. It worked out real well for us. I mean, real well, but, you know, the year before it didn't. So, I'm always going to be honest about, you know, pluses and minuses. But now this year, you know, I'm looking around like, okay, what's going to be up 20-30% this year? Well, if I knew that all the time, you know, whatever. But you're looking around. Now, there's some obvious stuff here, okay? Defense contractors appear to be going to get some more business, all right? Now, it looks like we're going to try and do something in regards to shipyards since we've only got six and we seem to need some ships. It also looks like there's maybe an opportunity one way or the other for our companies to go down and maybe spruce up for Democratic reasons, for whatever reasons, the Venezuelan oil stuff. And, you know, we can never forget that Venezuela has the biggest proven reserves of anybody in the world, including Saudi. So it's not like there's nothing there. Now, I hear today, not specifically Exxon, but somebody was writing, I was hearing on the way in, that none of the oil companies at first blush want any part of going down there. It's not like they're hopping on the plane today to go down and start, you know, where can we invest? We want this refinery, we want this oil, you know, this hole in the ground, or whatever you want to call it, drilling facility. I mean, is any of this going to turn into consistent enough stuff to where guys like us can put some money in it and make some dough? Or is it all just what, you know, this is
well,
this
before
week's,
I'm just saying, before the oil companies the oil firms themselves go down there, you got to get the support companies like the Kellogg Brown and Root that was, you know, Cheney's old firm, right. or Schlumberger. They're the ones that got to go in there and refit the refineries and all that. And then you get the oil companies. So I'd be watching the support companies before I'd be looking at the actual guys pumping the oil and shipping it.
Well, do you say,
Chief? Yeah. And Chief, as you said, they're not. There's reporting that they're not that eager. And there's maybe a couple reasons. One is the questionable quality of the oil, and that goes to Wayne's point of how hard is it to get it out and make money out of it. The other is oil, as you mentioned on the show, or Jimmy does every day, the price per barrel right now is not that high. And two, or three, when you think about it, you're going to send people down there if you're a company, and you got to protect them in what may be years of chaos. I mean, what happens if the dictatorship people down there now don't do what Trump wants? Well, they're out, you got chaos, and if you're a company, do you really want a whole bunch of employees down there? what are they going to do?
Well, yeah, and you what you've got now down there is militias forming up around each of the three power centers that are left. You've got the vice president, Delcy, the woman who, now there's word that she may have been paid off by the people close to Trump to basically allow the kidnapping of Maduro to take place. You got the head of the intelligence service. He's a tough hombre. And then you got the head of the military. And all three of them now apparently are forming their own militias and power centers. And we may not have seen the end of this. There could be a civil war breaking out there now.
And the starting point is to read what all of these people say, including our people, but also those people. They didn't get to where they were and by saying what their actual plans and thoughts and hopes are. There's a lot of backstabbing that we can count on through the decades for them to get where they are. And why would the oil companies want to get involved?
And by the way, the head of the armed services, a general, his first name is Vladimir.
Really? hey, how about a simpler one? I talked with Lou at length about the Lockheed situation. Now, just if nobody was listening earlier, they make the Patriot missile. They cost $5 million a pop. And they're talking about, last year they stretched and made 620 of them. Evidently, the government is thinking about a 10-year deal where they're going to make 2,000 a year for the next 10 years. Now, I don't know how much if the contract will be that long or be re-extended, but me just being sort of in those kinds, not in that industry, but if the best you could do last year was 620 and you're looking for 2,000, you at least need to double, maybe triple your, whether it's you got a huge building, can you have three lines where you have one? Probably not. You need another factory in another city. Somehow or another, somebody has to spend like a real lot of dough here to go from 620 to 2,000. I mean, without knowing the situation, I can't put a number on it, but something has to happen. It's not like you did 620 and you're trying to get 700 next year. So, now, could I be a simpleton and say, well, they make $500,000 a missile, and oh, by the way, the Lockheed's this big, the stock's X. I think the stock's going to be, you know, X times 10% higher next year. Can anybody count on this, or is it something a year from now, screw it, make 2,000 one year, and then we'll pay you for investment, and you're done? Or is any of this stuff investable? I mean, given the fact that it seems to change every day.
I would just add is what's happening now with the U.S. disengaging from NATO and Europe and whatnot, European defense companies are starting to really haul in some major contracts. Apparently, Canada is not going to buy the F-35. They're going to go with the Swedish fighters, the Gripen fighters that are produced by Saab. Same with a lot of other countries over in Europe and elsewhere. So, and the Germans are stepping up their military production. So, you know, I'd be looking at some of the big German defense firms. I think Rheinmetall is one of them. So I'm looking at Trump criticized Europe for not doing enough for defense. Be careful of what you wish for, because they are really stepping up. Sweden, Germany, Switzerland, and other countries over there.
Well, we have such inconsistency in the we have the whole idea that Canada is totally screwing us. Yet the average American buys $1,500 worth of crap from Canada, and the average Canadian buys $9,000 worth of crap from us. So, I mean, someplace, somewhere, you have to look at how exactly are we being screwed by every Canadian, if that's the case. But somehow we're believing this, and I don't know. I mean, the story last week I was listening to is that they now have their own liquid natural gas facility in Vancouver. They no longer have to do that here. Ooh. In Canada. So now,
well, and they're not buying Kentucky booze. Jim Beam closed production for a year because of the Canadian boycott. So
what's Pete Hegseth going to do now?
Well, you know, you're right, Andrew. I mean, there's the lack of consistency here makes it really hard for me to commit people's money to this stuff.
Well, I think what Wayne was saying better than my summary is the upside in European defense markets or producers might be more predictable.
I would also add South Korea.
Huge upside.
Yeah. Yeah, South Korea, and you know, Japan is limited what they can do by the Constitution. MacArthur told them they had to, you know, no offensive military. But now we see Japan starting to at least talking about it, if not actually doing it, going full bore on their own military.
Well, I think they're going to have to.
Defense industry.
We have to dash, but the only problem with that is now if you guys plunk money at PTI to do that, that's a two-step transaction. We're going to have to go get euros, so it's a currency transaction and a stock transaction. That's a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, we could do it, but now all of a sudden you got two variables and not one. One's hard enough, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we could make 20% on the stock and lose 20% on the euro, and we're back to break even, right?
Yeah, with the currency. Yeah, and the currency market. I just know this from listening to you, Chief. Yeah, it's volatile.
Well, guys, Happy New Year. I'm sorry we missed the last couple of weeks. We'll make up for it. And have a Happy New Year. And this year, let's resolve to have a cocktail somewhere, even if it's summer, fall, whatever.
Absolutely.
SP Futures down 7, NASDAQ Futures down 44. Not much going on there. I'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.